Did you see the IMF?
Hello, fellow Rebel Capitalists. Hope you're well. We're going to let you in on this insider information that Mark Moss and I are having right now. Mark, go ahead and continue, buddy.
I was just saying, if you saw the paper the IMF put out last week on the Bitcoin cross-border flows.
No, fill me in.
So the IMF published a paper April 5th. It's titled A Primer on Bitcoin Cross-Border Flows, Measurement and Drivers. So April 5th, it's on the IMF website. You can go find it. I'll give you the summary, and then I'll give you some bullet points that I pulled out that I think we can discuss.
Great.
On the IMF paper, if you pull it up, I can drop the link here if you want. And do you want me to drop the link here?
Sure. Yeah, or Josh, you want to?
I'll just drop it in the private chat so Josh, you can get it. But right on the homepage before you get into it, it just says summary. Bitcoin cross-border flows respond differently than capital flows to traditional drivers of capital flows. So Bitcoin flows respond differently than capital flows to traditional drivers of capital flows. And differences appear between on-chain and off-chain Bitcoin cross-border flows. Off-chain cross-border flows seem correlated with incentives to avoid capital flow restrictions.
Mm.
That's the summary. And they dig into it. So I pulled some bullet points that we can discuss.
So this takes me back to Argentina. When we just a couple weeks ago, as you know, we drove across Argentina and we were trying to sell gold, Bitcoin, silver to get from Santiago over to BA. And silver was okay. Gold, very difficult. Most people didn't want it. Those who did, they're charging us like a 50% haircut. And Bitcoin, we couldn't really get any takers. And we got a couple people to buy it, but we really had to talk them into it and say, hey, dude, we're in a pinch. You know, you'd really help us out. And they wanted USDT.
Yeah.
And so we said, look, we just got Bitcoin right now. Can we just give you the Bitcoin? You can give us, you know, give us a 20% haircut. Just give us the cash so we can afford to pay our hotel bill. And then you can just take the Bitcoin and then buy your USDT if that's what you actually want. So, but the thing there, a lot of people online took that as me being bearish or negative on Bitcoin. And that wasn't really the case because if you think about why there was almost zero liquidity for Bitcoin or gold, it wasn't Bitcoin or gold centric. I think the bigger issue was the banking system doesn't function. So if you have any asset, even real estate, if you can only pull out $40 a day and your currency is hyperinflating, how are you going to sell? Because what are you going to take $100,000 worth of pesos in cash? Because you definitely don't want your purchasing power in the banking system because then it's trapped.
Right.
And then your only other option is to sell for cash dollars unless the two parties have a bank account outside of Argentina.
Right.
But then no one's going to give you those dollars because everyone's hoarding them. It's Gresham's law
down there. Where
they're hoarding the dollars. So I'm going to be very curious to know how this is different in Turkey, where I believe the banking system is actually functional. At least it was the last time I went there, although they're experiencing probably the same levels of hyperinflation. Yeah. So going back to your report, how do you kind of reconcile? I would assume the growth in the off-chain, like with Lightning, I think is what you're referring to, we would see that more so in places like Turkey or
I have a list of the countries.
Yeah, go ahead.
I'll read them to you. But I think I did see that. And obviously we had talked offline. I was in Santiago, Chile. Unfortunately, we didn't get to hang out when we were there. I think at the same time, ironically, I think it's the largest Bitcoin, or it wasn't Bitcoin. It was the largest, it's called America's Digital. So it's a tech conference basically. And it's for Latin America. And there was nothing really Bitcoin there. It was more like cybersecurity and payment options, things like that. I spoke at a fintech thing. I spoke at two things. Anyway, you know, I've been spending a lot of time in Mexico. I'm building a house in Mexico right now. And then I was just in Santiago, Chile, and nobody wants dollars there either, George. nobody in Mexico wants dollars anymore. Now I've been going to Mexico forever. And
what do they want?
They want pesos. The peso is so strong against the dollar. Nobody wants dollars in Mexico right now.
Right.
And this has been going on for a while since, you know, when Trump got elected the first time, it was at 22 to 1. Right now it's about 15 or 16 to 1, right? So the peso is very strong. And nobody wants the dollar in Mexico anymore. It's crazy. I've been going there forever. Dollar was almost the same as a peso down there, except for, you know, I spend a lot of time in very remote parts of Mexico. for my dirt bike trips and stuff like that. And in the more remote parts, they'll only take dollars on a steep discount because they know they have to drive whatever 2 hours to go exchange them for the pesos they need. Mm-hmm. It sort of reminds me of the free banking era. In the free banking era of the United States, the banks weren't allowed to open up multiple branches across multiple states. And so the further you got away from where that currency unit was issued, yeah, the deeper the discount would be. And so when I'm using dollars, when I used to use dollars in remote parts of Mexico, I'd pay at a steep discount, sort of like what you offered in Argentina for Bitcoin or gold. But even in like Cabo San Lucas, they don't want dollars anymore. And I was in Santiago, Chile, and I couldn't find, I flew down with a couple hundred dollars in my pocket. I couldn't find anyone to change them for me. My hotel wouldn't change them for me. And so same thing, right? Nobody wants dollars. Opposite. Well, it's the opposite, but the point is that they need to kind of deal with the currency units that they have in that location, and they don't want dollars, they don't want Bitcoin, they don't want gold. They just need those currency units.
Well, Argentina, they wanted dollars.
They wanted
dollars. What's interesting about that, though, Mark, I don't know if I told you this part, but you got a much better exchange rate on $100 bills.
Okay.
So if you got, as an example, if you had a $100 bill, they'd give you like a 1,000 pesos for $1. Let's say, but if you had a 20, they'd only give you like 900.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Yeah. Huh. Yeah.
That's
so that was kind of like the most pristine asset in that version of Gresham's law. But you know what that boils down to is just what's the dollar doing relative to the local currency in Mexico. I don't know of any other country over the last 4 or 5 years where the dollar has actually gone down.
The ruble.
Where's the ruble at right now?
I haven't looked, but I mean, it was the ruble and the real office also was really strong. I think that's been falling since the whole election happened.
Brazil?
The Brazil real was really strong over the last couple of years. I think since the election happened, it's been dropping off a cliff, right?
Yeah, it's been terrible. I did a video the other day where I looked at most of the major economies in the United States, which included Japan. I did not include Russia or China, but Japan, India, UK, Germany, Italy, Brazil. I don't know if I said that. And what you saw since 2012 is the dollar not only went up against their currency, but it actually went up against goods and services.
Mm.
So the reason I was stating that is because you always hear that the dollar is just the cleanest dirty shirt in the laundry hamper, meaning that all fiat currencies are going down relative to goods and services. But it's not true. It's not true if you live in Japan. It's the opposite. The dollar is gaining in value relative to the stuff that you have to buy. But what you're saying, which makes a lot of sense, is in Mexico, the dollar actually is losing value relative to the stuff they have to buy, which at the end of the day is all they care about.
Yeah. I don't know if it matters, but Josh, if you want to look it up, I believe the Brazilian real was gaining on the US dollar up until the last election. I don't know if that matters. And the ruble did for a while as well. But regardless, I mean, these are small periods of time. If you look at the long trend, I think it's pretty clear. But
the reason I went back to 2012 is because I think that the monetary system really changed after the GFC as far as global dollar debt and the collateral issues. And I think that's pretty much what led to the dynamic that we see with the dollar relative to goods and services in these major economies.
Yeah. So a couple of things. One, I think, you know, I saw some of your comments about, you know, traveling down there and couldn't find people to take it. And you already mentioned, right, Gresham's law, obviously, right? Bad money driving out good. Mm-hmm. And, you know, where we're at and the way that I see it is like, why would you spend your Bitcoin, spend fiat, right?
No, they don't want to buy it. But that's what a lot of pushback I got online is, yeah, why would they spend their Bitcoin? Why would they spend their Bitcoin? I'm like, no, it's not that they won't take it for transactions.
They didn't want to buy it.
They won't even buy it. Right. So, yeah.
Well, for a lot of those places, I mean, they're not saving a lot of money, right? So Bitcoin's good for savings. I mean, I think it's shown that it's a very good long-term store of value. You know, if you look at a 3-4 year period, it's done amazingly well. But the volatility in the short term is very dangerous. So if you're like living paycheck to paycheck, I mean, the volatility could be very bad for you.
Yeah, I don't think that's it either. Because if you go down and look, it's like very similar to Santiago, where there's a huge middle class, not only Mendoza, but Cordoba. Rosario is a little sketchy. But then also in BA, I think it goes back to the banking system. Because let's just say, Mark, that you had $50,000 worth of gold and you wanted to buy a house. And you're in Argentina. How do you do it?
Well, you would have to either one, find somebody that owned their house cash and would be willing to take your gold in exchange, or two, you'd have to find someone to change your gold into the currency that they would want to accept.
But you're not going to want to do that unless you've got that buyer lined up.
Right.
If you got the buyer lined up, great. But the buyer's not going to take the currency. You see, then you run into
the gold,
that
you
problem.
No.
Okay. So let's assume that you can sell your gold for the local currency.
Oh, they don't want the local currency.
They don't want the local currency because now they're, let's just say they have $100,000 with the local currency.
It's trapped in the current system. Yeah.
Yeah. That's losing value at 20% per month.
Yeah.
And now if you can get the cash, then that's okay because you can try to buy dollars, but there's not enough dollars. So what you have is, because I got this a lot online as well, where people said, well, if they just would have bought gold, they meaning the normal Argentinian, let's say 5 years ago, or if they would have bought Bitcoin, then they'd be fine. They'd have nothing to worry about. But that's not understanding the problem, because even if they did have Bitcoin, they can't sell it. And the reason they can't sell it is not because there's not a global market for it, but the only option they have to sell doesn't work for any buyer. And so you get this stalemate.
So what you're saying is the person selling the house wouldn't want to accept currency because that currency then is trapped in the banking system. So what that seller really wants is cash.
Well, even if they get the peso cash, let's just say you get $100,000.
It's losing value. Cash. So what they really want is either US dollar cash or UST tokens.
Yeah. And well, most of them aren't going to take USDT because they're not at that level.
Right. You know,
they're not, what we saw are kind of like the younger people and like the tech geek guys. They were the people that were interested in the USDT. But the only other, as far as going back to the house example, the only thing they could do is just take cash dollars. And then how do you travel with those?
Yeah.
And then where do you find them?
Yeah.
Because they're so scarce. You can find like $40 a day if you go down to the Cambio. But to get like $100,000 or $250,000, it's just not realistic. So it's this weird dynamic where even if you own Bitcoin, you still have counterparty risk. From the standpoint of you can't get anyone to buy it, and the same thing with gold. And what's ironic there is it's a result of the fiat system that you're trying to get out of not functioning.
Right.
Yeah.
The irony.
It's crazy.
I think, you know, the one thing I think back and is that money, if you go back to, you know, beginning of time, money changed from feathers, rocks, seashells, et cetera. Money is an emergent process and it's evolutionary. So it takes time, right? Oh, look at this cool rock. It's a collectible. Eventually, because it's so rare, could become a store of value. Maybe. Not every collectible becomes a store of value. Some, obviously, baseball cards become stores of value. Fine art becomes stores of value. But not all collectibles do. And then if it has the right attributes, the money attributes, it could, not always, but could evolve to the next stage of a medium of exchange. So obviously durable, storable, portable, divisible, fungible, et cetera, right? And so a Mona Lisa is not divisible, right? A cow is divisible, but it's not fungible. Bananas aren't durable, right, et cetera. And so it could emerge, but this evolutionary process takes a very long time. Then you also look at, and that's money, right? So that's a monetary network, which is a lot more, network effects are very powerful. Like I can create a copy of Twitter, but doesn't mean anybody's going to use it. But monetary network effects are even more powerful because what you choose as money is very important. Like China didn't want to go to the gold standard. They stayed on the silver standard. They lost their position in the world. But I think this is an evolutionary process. But then you look at technology. So there's something called a diffusion of innovation. It's like the bell curve. So you have like the innovators, then the true believers, then you have the chasm before the early majority comes in. And so, you know, we have this, I believe we're in this chasm right now before the early majority starts to come in. I think we're crossing that chasm right now. That's where something psychologically has to shift that makes it more mainstream. But even in the United States, where we're probably a lot more tech savvy, let's say, than probably, you know, third world countries, although there's other reasons why maybe we wouldn't adopt it. But even still, you can go down to the local mall, whatever, and talk to 100 people. And probably most people don't know about Bitcoin or wouldn't want to buy Bitcoin there either. So I think a lot of it is just because we're in this brand new technological period. And so really what you have to do is you have to look at these little pockets of hotspots, these little pockets, and see what's kind of working there. And then you can sort of extrapolate that this potentially starts to grow. So, you know, I saw you interacting with that girl's tweet. She was talking about in Costa Rica how she has this Bitcoin circular economy. And she's buying in Bitcoin, selling in Bitcoin. And to your point, I agree, that's not your unit of account. And so it's not really truly what you're doing.
Well, most people couldn't afford to do that, even if they wanted to, because they can't afford to take the risk that their expenses are going to fluctuate by 20% every single month.
I agree.
How do you get past that volatility issue in order for it to make the jump from the store of value to the medium of exchange? Because to me, that's the real problem.
Yeah, I agree. I'm going to give you a perfect example. I'll admit to everybody here. I'm building a house in Mexico on the beach. A beautiful friggin' house. It's my dream location. I've been dreaming forever. It's very expensive. And I have cash sitting in the bank because everything has to be paid for in cash. You and I have talked about this, deploying a lot of cash at this point in the market, but I don't care. I'm deploying cash to do this. Now, it takes a long time to build a house. And that money, and I'm a Bitcoin guy. And so like that money could have been sitting in Bitcoin and I would have more than doubled my money. I would have paid for the whole cash just from the profits, but I don't have it sitting in Bitcoin because I need to pay cash and I can't deal with the risk of the volatility bringing the value down. I don't have the money to pay for the house.
The opposite. Yeah. The house is double expensive.
So the house is
the opposite. Yeah,
exactly. So I'm a victim of the volatility as well. I'm sitting in cash, even though I could have in hindsight, oh man, look how much I could have made. I could have paid the house with, but I didn't because of the volatility. So I get it. Now to answer your question, because it's this evolutionary path, right? The asset has to become big enough and the volatility to come down. So what we can already see in Bitcoin's, small 15-year future is that the volatility has already come down in a massive way. I mean, we've seen it having 90% drawdowns, 85% drawdowns, 80, right? And they get less and less and less. The volatility swings in 2017, for example, Bitcoin ran from $1,000 to $20,000 in a year. And we saw 9 pullbacks of 25% or more, right? Today, we're not seeing that. The pullback.
10% pullbacks daily.
I get it, George, but
not 20. It's damn volatile, Mark.
George, I'm not saying it's not volatile. What I'm saying is it used to be 25%. Yeah. Now we're seeing 10. Another 10 years from now, there'll be 5, right? And so like I believe as the asset continues to get bigger, as more people use it, and one thing I'm not a fan of, but probably as we get more financialization and we have the hedge funds going long and short, it'll start to really bring that volatility down. Mm-hmm. But that only is going to happen over a period of time, over this evolutionary process as the asset gets bigger. And I think it'll probably be, in less than a decade. I think in 6-7 years, we'll probably be there.
Yeah, I think it's all about market cap. That's the conclusion. Whenever I try to think about this, and I've given it quite a bit of thought, that's where I always come to. It's like the market cap has to get to a point where you just reduce that vol down to a level of, let's say, gold or something. So then the risk reward makes a lot of sense, even for the average Joe or the average Jose in this example.
But let's talk about the risk reward for a second, George. Let's talk about the risk and reward for a second. So if you're in Manhattan sipping a $20 Mai Tai, like what do I care about the money? My dollar is pretty good. But when you're in Lebanon or Turkey or Venezuela or Peru or any of these other countries, like you have to get out of your currency no matter what. Like you're going to friggin' lose everything. So when you talk about the risk reward, if I'm going to lose everything anyway, why not go into Bitcoin, right? If I'm in Nigeria where they're pushing the ENIR on me, why not? So the risk reward are different for us in the US.
So why isn't everyone in Turkey saving in Bitcoin? Because
it's a brand new asset that most people haven't heard about yet.
I don't buy that. In the United States, I totally buy it. Because there isn't that type of incentive, right? There isn't that type of urgency. But to your point, when your currency, when your savings, or whatever you have at the end of the month, when you pay your expenses, if that's losing 20%, you're that lights a fire under your ass where you're like, what the F am I going to do here? And I got a lot of pushback on Twitter. They're like, oh, well, they're just financially not sophisticated. No.
No, it's because the volatility.
Argentinians are way more sophisticated than Americans when it comes to finance. Just live through 10 years of hyperinflation and see how sophisticated you are when it comes to saving your purchasing power. So I don't think it's, I don't know what 10 years would do that hyperinflation won't do. As far as an incentive structure,
the problem is just there's a bunch of problems. So there's the technical savvy part, there's the information knowledge problem, but I think there's also the savings problem. I mean, 75% of the world lives on less than $10 a day. Okay. So Bitcoin's not really saving them today. They don't have any savings. They make $10 a day. 50% of the world lives on less than $5 a day. So in a culture where I need to, I need to earn and live constantly, I can't deal with the volatility. We're both in agreement on that. So it's really working for savers today. But let's dig into this IMF paper because it answers some of these questions. So a couple points. So one, they make the case that Bitcoin is working as a hedge against global uncertainty. So what they said, I'll read a quote here. IMF study provides evidence that increased Bitcoin activity occurs as investors move away from risk assets. So the quote, an increase in the VIX is associated with higher Chainalysis inflows. So Chainalysis is the software they use to like look at the movement across the Bitcoin network. Okay. So they said an increase in the VIX is associated with higher Chainalysis inflows and outflows, meaning people moving in and out of the Bitcoin. This significant positive response may reflect increased activity via the Bitcoin market as investors move away from risk assets. So what they're saying is it's working as a risk off asset. And I pulled this up just as a side note here because I thought it'd be interesting to talk about. But what we can see in times of turmoil, geopolitical events, I have a handful of geopolitical events here to look at. The Cyprus financial crisis that happened in 2013, Bitcoin went up 47% while gold went down 7.5%. The Syrian civil war, 2015 to 2016, Bitcoin went up 348%, gold went down 10%. The Libyan civil war, 2011, Bitcoin went up 300%, gold went up 20%. Arab Spring, 2012, Bitcoin went up 24%, gold went up 17%. The Taiwan South China Sea tensions in 2016, Bitcoin up 68%, gold down 14%. Russian invasion of Ukraine, Bitcoin up 41%, gold up 24%. The total conflict in Ukraine from 2014 to present, I mean, that's kind of irrelevant. And then the recent Israel Hamas conflict, Bitcoin's up 76%, gold's up 20%. So those are just, that wasn't in the IMF report. I pulled that up separately. But that's the quote from the IMF paper that they, based off of the flows in and out, it seems to reflect that people are moving to it as a risk off asset.
Maybe. I mean, you look at what Israel did the other night or what Iran did the other night and Bitcoin just tanked. So maybe. I think you know as well as I do.
I mean, anyone looking at their assets on a weekly basis is never going to make it.
Yeah, but if you want to correlate it directly with geopolitical risk, I think.
But it doesn't move on a day-by-day basis. You have to kind of give it a little
bit. Why wouldn't it? If you got basically Iran or Israel getting that much closer to World War III, you would think that you would see some price action in gold or Bitcoin that would reflect that risk.
So if we look at a couple months, so since it started, I think is a fair time to look at it. So since it started, so in the last 6 months.
Right, Bitcoin but when you got Iran dropping missiles on Israel, if you, wouldn't you be risk off?
Well,
I mean, I would be. I'd be like, holy shit, we're on the doorstep of World War III. I want the safest asset as I can possibly buy. And if Bitcoin's that asset, I want to buy Bitcoin.
Well, it's up three times what gold is.
Right. But no, but I'm saying during these events, when we're getting real, real close to World War III and you don't know what's going to happen tomorrow, you don't know how Israel's going to respond. If you have a risk off asset, you would assume that that risk off asset would go up substantially during, you know, a time when Iran or Israel are dropping missiles on each other.
Yeah, I think okay. Well, this is what the IMF paper says. You know, obviously we can view it different ways. I don't think things are a one-to-one move like that. But another thing they said is they said that people are using it to get around capital controls. They said in the paper, despite what many say, Bitcoin is looked at as a risk-off asset. Bitcoin is used to flee instability in local economies. IMF study concludes that people are turning to Bitcoin to get around capital controls. The quote here, I pulled a quote, cross-border outflows are positively correlated with a Bitcoin parallel premium, which we interpret as a broader proxy for exchange rate pressures, reflecting macroeconomic imbalances. This finding indicates that Bitcoin may be used to circumvent capital controls.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, look, there is no better purchasing power as far as portability than Bitcoin. I mean,
right.
Especially when you combine that with the decentralization. In fact, I tweeted the other night, I said, look, let's just assume that Bitcoin never becomes a medium of exchange. Let's assume that it never really becomes a store of value, or let's assume that it never becomes a risk-off asset. So what? So what? The fact that it's so portable and decentralized, that's a win in the Bitcoin category, regardless of what happens from here.
Yeah, because you can use it as a peer-to-peer, censorship-resistant,
immutable. Absolutely. I mean, look at the and again, I think we're going to have a lot more luck in Turkey than we had in Argentina. I think I'm very confident that Bitcoin and gold are going to be liquid there. And assuming they are, think about what that does, right? And I was trying to have this, I was going through this thought experiment with Macintosh the other day, where we're like, look, let's just say that you get locked out of the US banking system because you're like you or I, where we're sitting here talking about Klaus and all these things. I mean, you know, your social score is going to go to zero just as fast as mine is, Mark.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure.
We're going to be right there at the finish line, buddy.
Yeah.
So, you know, they freeze our account. So, I mean, you've got a family, you've got people you got to take care of. So in the interim, you want purchasing power outside of the system. So let's just say your magic number is 250. Okay, right. Great. How are you going to get 250 in gold over to your plan B? Let's say your plan B place is Costa Rica or something like that. There's no way. Or how are you going to get 250 in dollar bills or $100 bill? It ain't going to happen. Silver, no chance. Zero. Really, your only option at that time is something like Bitcoin. If you have to transact outside of the system, and then you say, well, there's a lot of things that are portable. Fine. But there's nothing that's decentralized. And that's the key.
And that's really the key. I went and spoke at, I think I told you, I spoke at a Sovereign Man's event down there in Mexico City a few weeks ago. And of course, Peter Schiff was there. And I talked about this specifically. He didn't like what I had to say so much. But
Peter's a good dude. He's a good dude. And he pushback and everything.
Oh yeah, yeah. No, but it was the portability, and I said, look, man, in the industrial age, but even gold really failed because in 1459 in Venice, Italy, Luca Pavioli created a new technology called the ledger and double entry accounting.
Yeah.
And that's when gold stopped being used and we went into sort of this information world from a physical world of moving gold physically to an information world where somebody keeps the ledger. But I said, you know, since then, technology hasn't changed. Money technology is the same as it was in 1459. Today, we live in a world of instant transactions. I can click a button and have Amazon delivered today at my house. So we have instant transactions, but settlement is still the same as it was thousands of years ago. And gold specifically, you know, because it was based on this gold system. And now to your point that you're making, I agree, right? Now, Bitcoin is money for a digital age where we can have instant transactions and instant settlement at the same time. It's a pretty big deal.
Hey guys, I want to invite each and every one of you to join me May 31st through June 2nd in Orlando for Rebel Capitalist Live. This is the annual conference I do. And this year it's going to be absolutely incredible. We're going to have some of your favorites there as speakers, guys like Jeff Snyder, Mike Green, The Real Estate, Kenny McElroy. We're going to have Robert Barnes. They're talking about freedom and liberty. Even Rich Cooper is going to be there discussing red pill issues. This event is all about giving you the intel, the insider information you need to not only survive 2024, but thrive. The whole reason I created this event was to give you the tools you need to build the future you deserve for yourself and your family. This is an event you are not going to want to miss. So to get more information, go to rebelcapitalistlive.com. You can see a full list of speakers we've had in the past. You can see clips from past events, and most importantly, you can get your tickets. As we get closer to the event, the tickets go up in price. So you're going to want to get those ASAP at rebelcapitalistlive.com. And we will see you in Orlando, May 31st through June 2nd.
But can you help me understand that, Mark? Because can you have instant settlement in Lightning? I thought Lightning was still a netting process.
It is. So it's like a batching process. So sort of like a credit card, right? So a credit card batches and then it settles, right? But
that's how the monetary system works, is they don't settle each transaction. They just net out at the end of the night or something like
that. They net out at the end of the night. You're right. So, but the difference is, George, as you always say, there's trade-offs, right? The cost benefit analysis. So everything has a trade-off. And what happens is if I use Venmo, the trade-offs are different than if I use PayPal. Or if I use my credit card, if I use a check, should I pay with my debit card or my credit card? And it allows me, the user, to trade off what I'm willing to trade off. So when you talk about Lightning, for example, George, I mean, I'm going to use that for a cup of coffee. Does a cup of coffee have to be censorship resistant and immutable for all of history? No, of course not. So I'm willing to take the trade off of netting out at the end of the day because it's like a cup of coffee. But if I'm going to buy your house, I'm going to wait the 10 minutes and I'm just going to let it settle, right? So it allows me to choose the level of censorship resistant and immutability that I want, the fee structure that I want based off of what it is that I need.
Yeah. yeah. If you want to settle instantly, you can.
Yeah, if I want to, but I'm willing to take the trade-off that doesn't settle to the end of the day. Whereas if I, you know, if I want the final settlement, then I'll just wait.
Yeah.
So kind of digging into this again, developing markets, Bitcoin flows are larger in emerging and developing markets, which I think you would probably understand. The IMF study concludes that Bitcoin flows are typically larger in developing markets compared to advanced economies. Countries with the largest Bitcoin flows, say Chile, Venezuela, Moldova, Nigeria, and Central African Republic.
Moldova, that's...
80% of... they didn't put this in the paper, but I know this from other research. 80% of all Bitcoin transactions under $1,000 are happening in Africa.
That makes sense.
So there, and what does that tell you? That means they're... we don't know for sure conclusively, but I believe that means they're using it for more like day-to-day types of transactions, right? Small transactions. We know in Nigeria, so Nigeria pushed the first CBDC, well, not the first, but one of the, probably the second, the e-Naira, they call it. Mm-hmm. And nobody wanted to use it because the Naira was so bad, the hyperinflation was so bad, people had already started using Bitcoin. And when they pushed the e-Naira, the Nigerians wouldn't use it. And so they tried the carrot first, which is, hey, if you use it, we'll give you discounts on your pedicabs and things like that. But still nobody would use it. So then they came out with the stick. And the stick was, now you can't get cash out of the bank. And it crashed the whole system. Nigeria had to back off. The EIRA is burned. It's gone. They couldn't force it. They caused a massive crisis in Nigeria because of this. And so Bitcoin has already taken a stronghold there. But anyway, those are the countries with the largest Bitcoin flows. A common theme shared by all of these countries is a high rate of currency debasement, right? Obviously.
Yeah. Where I go is just what is the variable that would explain the delta between Nigeria and Argentina? What is it? It's not a lack of technology. It's not a lack of understanding. It's not a lack of financial sophistication. That's what I'm searching for. What is the difference? It's not cultural. It's not that
Argentinians, I think it's time.
Don't like,
I think,
gold, I think, I think, or don't like Bitcoin. But why? It's had just as much time in Argentina as it has had in Nigeria. I don't know. There's got to be something else there that. And yeah, I keep going back to the banking system, but what you're saying is the banking system is just as dysfunctional, if not more so, in Nigeria. So maybe that's not it.
I think, you know, adoption rates are uneven, right? Why do some people pick up new tech? It took the telephone 80 years to get to an 80% penetration, which is what they consider like a full penetration. So 80 years, like why did some people use the telephone before other people, right? Color TVs took about 30 years. Right? Why did some people use color TVs earlier than other people using color TVs? You know, just adoption rates are just different for different reasons. And obviously culturally they're different as well. And like I said, even in the United States, which I would say, and you know, the say under 50 crowd, still the amount of people that know about Bitcoin and buy Bitcoin, even in the United States under this crowd, you know, sort of tech friendly type crowd, it's still very low. But it's the, you know, you show charts all the time. The reason why you show charts, or the reason I like to show charts, is I want to see the direction, but I also want to see the size and the speed of the move. So like the direction, we can see the Bitcoin growth by the addresses with a non-zero balance. So the Bitcoin network is what we call anonymous. It's not private, but it's anonymous, right? So we can see all the transactions. We just don't know who they belong to. And so we can see the addresses that have a non-zero balance. And we know that there was 52 million of these with a positive balance. Today, 2 weeks ago, it was 51. So we've added a million wallets in with balance in just 2 weeks. Mm-hmm. Now, I can have as many wallets as I want, so this isn't necessarily a one-to-one, but typically a non-zero wallet means that there's more users using it. If the wallet goes to zero, then there's less people using it. So that's a million wallet increase in just 2 weeks from 51 to 52. Right, that's a pretty big deal. And so it's the direction, right? It's the direction and the speed and size of the move.
Yeah. Yeah. I'll be very curious to see how this plays out in Turkey. And I almost, assuming that we have much better luck, I want to do a deep dive there, figure out why. And I almost want to go back to Argentina. You know what I mean? Knowing what I know now.
But I would guess if you went to major cities in the U.S., and did your same experiment. I'm guessing
you have hyperinflation. You see what I'm saying? I mean, you got to have that component of hyperinflation because to me, that would be like the ultimate incentive.
But what you do have in the U.S. to offset the hyperinflation is you have the gamble culture. So everybody here is looking to get rich. It's a big deal. Right?
I agree.
Have the gamble culture. And so everybody here is looking to gamble on something. And so, I mean, I see people do this. I mean, quite often on social media where they'll go to Las Vegas strip or whatever and say, hey, would you trade this for an ounce of gold or would you trade this for some Bitcoin? And people are like, no, I'll take the cash. I mean, all the time I see that. So I would guess you would have a very similar approach. Now, last summer, I went to Europe with my family for a month. We mostly were in Italy and Greece. And mostly through Italy, every time I saw a money changer place, they would list all the currencies. And Bitcoin was there, man. They were always changing Bitcoin. It was listed across with all the other currencies.
Well, yeah. So that takes me back to my hypothesis about the banking system. We'll have to see. I'm really curious. I'm very fascinated by this, as you can tell.
Yeah.
By what drives human beings to use something not only as a store of value but as a medium of exchange. And this trip really opened up my eyes. I had no idea. I thought the problem was going to be finding cambios or something like that.
I think that you have to have a reliable store of value. You have to become a store of value before you become the medium of exchange. Now, we see that those are separated today. Obviously, the dollar is a good medium of exchange, but it's not a good store of value. So those have become separated, and they could be. And you made the case earlier that even if it's not a good store of value, Bitcoin could still be used, peer-to-peer. So it could still be a medium exchange, even if it's not a good store of value. But I think we need to cross that store of value threshold first, which
I think we can go back. Too. That's another thing that's from a psychological standpoint, another thing that's extremely fascinating, gold right now, I would argue gold is not money. If your definition of money is a medium of exchange, gold isn't a medium of exchange.
No.
But it sure as hell is a store of value, or it has been for 5,000 years. That's for sure.
Yeah.
So I think everyone should own gold, but it doesn't necessarily mean that it's money. So you see my point there is it started off potentially as a store of value. And then it has moved now, and a medium of exchange, and it's moved now to the point where it's just a store of value. And it's not a medium of exchange anymore.
Yeah. So a couple things. I mean, we just had the halving, so I cut the supply in half. It just became now a verifiable, more scarce asset than gold. So it's the hardest.
Mark, can you finish your thought, and then can we circle back here? Because I'd really like to get your take and your knowledge as to how that impacts the miners.
Yeah. So, So what I was saying is it now became officially the hardest money in the world. So we look at the inflation rate. So gold has approximately a 1.5% inflation rate. That's the new supply of gold coming into the world. Now, theoretically, if people say that if gold hits $5,000, more people are going to mine gold and that inflation rate could increase. People might offset that argument and say, well, we've already got the easy gold out. And so maybe it wouldn't. We'll leave that. We don't know the answer to that. But we know that Bitcoin is verifiably scarce by the code. And now we're below the 1.5% threshold of new inflation coming to the market. And so economics 101 is just the equilibrium of supply and demand, right? So if demand stays the same, you cut the supply in half, theoretically, then the price should be going up. We can look at why the demand might go up. Obviously, we can talk about ETFs. We can talk about the Treasury needs to issue $25 trillion in treasuries this year. We can talk about all those reasons. We can talk about how the U.S. Just sanctioned Russia again, seizing more assets. So we'll see how that goes. So I think those push the demand. But on the supply side, now we're producing less than or a half of what we were before. And so you wanted to see what that does to the miners. So basically, just to catch your audience up if they don't understand, the supply issuance will never be more than 21 million, but it's released over time. Right. Every 4 years, the new supply of Bitcoin gets cut in half. That's why it's called a halving. We just had the fourth one. We went from producing or releasing 900 Bitcoin a day. Now we're at 450 a day. This will continue every 4 years until 2140, which is 116 years from now, and then we'll be fixed at 21 million. That's 21 million ever released. Now, we don't know, but maybe 5-6 million are lost and gone forever. So it's actually less than that. So now we have this inflation rate of less than 1.5%. As far as how that affects the miners, do you want me to jump to that?
Yeah, please.
Yeah. So obviously the miners are the ones that that are running the transactions on the Bitcoin network, and they get paid in two ways. So one, as they're processing these transactions and solving these mathematical puzzles, new coins are released. That's the inflation rate. That's the $4.50 a day now. Yep. They also get paid in transaction fees. Now, what we've seen is over time, the transaction fees are growing. So now they're making a larger and larger percentage of money off of the transaction fees as the new release of coins have gone down. However, if you're looking at it in Bitcoin terms, if you're using Bitcoin as your unit of account, what you'll see is actually transaction fees haven't gone up. They've gone up in US dollars. They haven't gone up in Bitcoin. Mm-hmm. That's one way to look at it. But miners need dollars to pay their bills, right? They got to pay their electricity bills in dollars, et cetera. And so as they're producing Bitcoin, they need to sell a good majority of those Bitcoin for dollars, and then they need to pay their operating expenses. So what happens is there's now less Bitcoin being released and given out to the miners. So a couple things. One, if the price of Bitcoin doubles, then everything stays the same. If the price of Bitcoin doesn't double, then what happens? Well, what happens is the miners that are existing, some of them are going to be underwater and losing money. And what happens is as the miners that are less profitable have to shut off their miners because they can no longer run them profitably anymore, then the coins that get released are now shared between less people. And what happens is there's something called a Bitcoin difficulty adjustment. So it looks at how much hashing power, how many miners are trying to earn these coins on a regular basis. And every 2 weeks that adjusts. So it adjusts for that. So as people shut off, more of those coins are distributed to the remaining people.
But the complexity of mining increases or decreases based on the amount of people that are mining.
That's correct. Yeah.
Huh. Wow.
Yeah. It's a very elegant and genius system that was set up. And so, we have, you know, a lot of publicly traded miners. So now with publicly traded funds, they have big treasury accounts. And so a lot of these people could probably run at a loss for a while, hoping for that Bitcoin price to kind of come back up to where they're in profit.
Or the transactions going on. I mean, that's the other lever to pull, right?
Yeah. So I think there's going to be a pretty big, I think as well as a lot of other people, I think there might be a pretty big surprise on the upside in Bitcoin mining stocks, the publicly traded stocks right now, because they just, with this halving that just happened, there's a new upgrade that just got put into the Bitcoin network that allows people to create assets on top of the Bitcoin network. Ordinals is what they're called. They're sort of like these NFTs, without getting too into the weeds on that unless you want to. But what that's done is it's created a lot more fees on top of the Bitcoin network. So the Bitcoin miners are actually making a lot of money right now. And so what happened is, buy the rumor, sell the news, a lot of people were expecting the Bitcoin miners to sell off because their profits would take a big hit. But all of a sudden this got introduced. And in the last week since this happened, the Bitcoin miners are just raking it in like way more than ever.
Wow.
And so I think there's going to be a surprise to the upside on the publicly traded mining stocks.
Yeah, we'll have to. So what are, for those people that want to follow that, Mark, what are some tickers that you would suggest following? Do you have any right off the top of your head?
I mean, the big ones are Mara. So Mara is a big one.
So M-A-R-A?
M-A-R-A, yep.
Okay.
Yep. A Riot.
R-I-O-T?
Yep, a Riot, yep. Okay. Clean Spark.
Clean Spark. I'm assuming you've got, do you go over this on your email list?
Yeah. We
How talk do people about get things. On your email list? That's probably easy.
Yeah, I mean, just go to onemarkmoss.com and you can sign up there.
Okay, Josh, can you put that in the chat, please, so people can join Mark's email list?
Yeah, onemarkmoss.com. So there, and then Iris Energy, like those are four that are pretty good that I keep an eye on. Everyone can just watch those. But I think it's gonna surprise the upside. Bitcoin miners sort of work like gold miners, right? They work multiples on what the commodity does itself, and they kind of move like on a 5-to-1 ratio. So they're much more volatile. They go up way more, but they also pull back a lot more as well.
Yeah, it's just the gold miners don't have any exposure to the transaction rate.
Right. They don't get that upside in that. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. It's really kind of a cool deal. Well,
so what we're expecting is that as this, the new supply continues to dwindle and eventually it runs out in 116 years, that the transaction fee should be more than enough to offset the loss of the new coins.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. Totally understand. Okay. So Josh was talking about gold in the title. Inflation. I don't know if you want to go over your thoughts on gold. I think, I mean, if you've got any ideas there, we could dive into that or just go into kind of what you see for U.S. consumer price inflation maybe over the next 6 months.
Yeah, I think that's maybe there's certainly a lot going on with gold, but I'm probably not the best expert to talk to on that. I think it's super interesting what's happening in China, and I think potentially breaking the kind of grip of the LBMA on the price of gold. And I think it could explode to the upside, but you could probably find people that are a little bit more technical on that side than I am.
Yeah.
But I think, you know, on the inflation side, I mean, I've been an inflation bull for a long time. I'm also, you know, the way that I look at things, George, is that something changed in 2008, and that was quantitative easing. And the way the central banks interact in the markets is just different today than it was 2007. And it's accelerated and it's got bigger. And that's why I remember we had dinner at Eric Sue's event in LA back in August. And I was like, man, it looks like the bear market's canceled. And you're like, how could you say that? You know, but I mean, we have Bitcoin's up, you know, 160% since then, because even though they haven't gone to pivot to a easing yet, I mean, come on, they're injecting money all different ways. They're jawboning the markets, et cetera. But when I look at just the sheer numbers, as I kind of threw out earlier, like the treasury issuance has doubled from before 2020, right? It was 20 trillion and now it's 25 trillion this year in treasury issuance. So I think that's number one. And it's not just the US. I mean, all the countries are just trying to ease as much as they can. China's doing the same thing. So I look at that. I'm an inflation bull. So I think one, a lot more money printing happening. But two, the other big driver for inflation for me is that as the world continues to break apart, we're just not cooperating like we used to. And you know, the US is trying to onshore, we're trying to nearshore things. That's going to push prices up. Obviously, I mean, rerouting oil around the Red Sea, that's pushing prices up. But then this big catalyst that just happened that I think this for me is my main driver of Bitcoin, is that without trust, partnerships, relationships, they don't work. The world doesn't work without trust. And the U.S. has violated trust in 1933 when they seized the gold, in 1971 when they defaulted on other nations' gold. We saw trust get violated when the truckers had their money seized in Canada, but then when Russia had their bank accounts seized. And so just this week, right, they decided to go ahead and give some of that money to Ukraine. And that's a big deal. One, it shows there's no rule of law in the United States anymore. It's a big deal. All these Russian oligarchs are getting their assets seized, and all that money in these offshore bank accounts, $30 to $40 trillion in offshore bank accounts, is not safe. Two, capital is not going to feel safe being held in the United States. And so all these nations now have to think about where they're going to store their wealth. And gold seems to be the big beneficiary of that. Obviously, we can see central banks are adding, you know, net gold right now, more gold than any time sort of in history. But what we also see, George, is that a lot of nations are moving into Bitcoin. It's not as big and pronounced as gold because it starts small, but President Bukele from El Salvador has been meeting with all the heads of the other nations. You see it all the time. He's spent a lot of time in the UAE, in Oman, in even Saudi Arabia, and you see him meeting with these heads of state. What would he be doing meeting with all these heads of nations? I mean, there's one topic I'm sure they're talking about, and that's about Bitcoin. But now we've seen a lot of these oil producing nations in the Middle East are now mining Bitcoin with their energy. Part of it is, I think the biggest driver isn't because they believe Bitcoin is going to be the reserve currency and they're trying to build exposure to it, which I think that's it. But the bigger piece is the way, and I don't know if you've looked at this, but Bitcoin mining is now re-engineering our entire power grids. Have you tapped into that much? So power grids, we need to have a high base load of power because when you turn your light on, you need light. But the problem is that we've been shutting down our base load power, nuclear in a lot of places in California, for example, and moving to unreliables, wind and solar, right? But when it's not windy and when it's not sunny, you don't have the power that you need. And so what power grid operators do is they run what's called like a peaker plant or like a backup plant. So when they need more power, they fire up the other station. So they're building an entire power grid station that's only used in time when they need the extra power. So what they've done specifically in Texas is where this is really working well for the last couple of years, is they're building up all this Bitcoin mining so they can build up their base load of power. And when they need the extra power, the Bitcoin miners just turn off because Bitcoin mining can be turned on and off like a light switch. So now they can build the power capacity to whatever, 150% of what they need. So they have a higher base load. The Bitcoin mining takes the excess. And when they need it, it's happened in Texas, I think three or four times the last couple of years, they shut it off and put all that power back onto the grid. And
where
now,
do they get the power to begin with? Because they're, it, because the bottom line on net, they're increasing the power demand, correct? That's what you mean by increasing the base load?
The base load, right.
So because where are they getting the extra base load?
Well, they're creating it, right? They're setting it up.
But how? Where does that come? Because that's got to come from coal or nat gas or
it's oil. Coming from, well, a lot of it in Texas is coming from wind and solar, surprisingly, because they've built so much that's not being used. A lot of it, like where Riot is in Texas, they've taken over like the old Alcoa smelting plant, aluminum plant, which used a lot of power. So it's coming from different sources. A lot of it in Texas is being used from flare gas, right? So all through all the oil fields, through the Bacon Shale in Texas, you know, they're drilling for oil. As oil comes out of the ground, natural gas comes out of the ground well. Because natural gas is so cheap, a lot of it is what we call abandoned or stranded is what they call it, because it's so far from a pipeline. I can't even get it to a pipeline. So I just let it either vent or I flare it off. And so they're setting up containers right at the wellhead and they're using the energy there. That doesn't really help the grid as much. But this is coming from grid power, right? So this is typically stuff that would either be wind and solar tied to the grid, or it's like from these like old power plants, like Alcoa, for example. But they've done this multiple times and there's reports of it. So they shut off, they push all the power back to the grid. The reason why this is important is two reasons. One, currently the plan is, the existing plan is to build a secondary power plant that only gets used in times of need. That's a lot of money going to waste. So now they can produce Bitcoin mining so they can turn that into a, you know, into a profit center and then push that power back. Now, the rest of the world wants to know about this. How can other countries that are producing a lot of natural gas and need a lot of high base load do the same thing? And so it's starting to change the world that way. We're starting to see, even in Africa, places that don't have energy, they want to put in a new hydro dam, for example, but there's not enough people there to make that hydro dam investment economically viable. Mm. So what they can do is they can put Bitcoin mining there until there's enough demand for the power, and then the Bitcoin mining can just leave and go somewhere else. Yeah. And so anyway, we're starting to see a lot of these other nations starting to adopt this. So I think that's going to be a pretty big deal. But also back to the point I was making about, you know, the seizure of Russia's assets only tells the rest of the world that your assets aren't safe in the United States. And I think that is like a big long-term driver of the demand.
Yeah, I agree. It's just your assets are also not safe if you can't find anyone to sell them to.
Yeah. So one of the attributes of money is it has to be saleable. People have to be willing to accept it.
Yeah. So, well, dude, it's always awesome, to have a conversation with you and go back and forth. You're going to be at Rebel Capitalist Live. I'm sure you're going to have some more incredible insights and information. You know, one thing one of the many reasons why I've always enjoyed talking to you is, you know, you're kind of the surfer guy and everything, but you're very philosophical. If for those of you who have ever had an opportunity to sit down and talk to Mark in real life, you know exactly what I'm talking about. And you really are a deep thinker. One of the deepest thinkers that I've probably ever met. So it's just really an honor to have you on the show and at Rebel Capitalist Live. If you guys want to get your tickets, you can get them at rebelcapitalistlive.com. Did I tell you that I was going back and forth with RFK the other day?
No.
Yeah.
On social media?
No, I've just reached, Barnes hooked me up with him, and I just was trying to get him to shoot out to Kenny's event. Are you going to be at Kenny's event?
Yeah, Limitless.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I don't want to kind of let the cat out of the bag. In fact, I probably shouldn't have said anything, but there's a, don't hold me to this, but there's a above zero probability that RFK might be there as well. Not at my event.
Yeah,
but at Kenny's event,
so. I got to hang out with him on Michael Saylor's yacht. We talked for a few minutes. I really kind of became a fan of his until I saw some of the policies that he has, and I'm not such a big fan of his anymore. But I got to talk to him for quite a while on Saylor's yacht. It was pretty cool. And then I hosted a Twitter Spaces with him at one point as well, which was pretty cool. Breedlove.
I've given up on all politicians, Mark, as far as their policies. Like, I've just come to the conclusion that no politician in my lifetime is ever going to be good. Right. So I've just got to go with the ones that I think are at least principled. And I think he might fall into that category. So
he seems like it. He seems like it. So I would definitely say that as well. You know, you look at the incentives though, right? So he's principled for those incentives. He's really against nuclear power. And he believes it's too dangerous and it's too expensive. And I tried to have that conversation with him, and it's like, whatever reports you can find, I mean, potentially from Chernobyl till today, we've had like 150 people have died from nuclear accidents. I would imagine more people die in Africa digging cobalt out of the ground. So it doesn't seem super dangerous. And that kind of made me doubt his decision making. And then, you know, he wants to subsidize housing for Americans. I mean, that's just more more welfare. But he does seem to be very pro-freedom. And that is probably more important.
And another thing, too, I do get the vibe from him that he is someone that would be open to changing his mind. It like going back to nuclear as an example. I think that if he was given, you know, maybe a presentation from people that he respected, that maybe he'd be, he isn't so dogmatic. Maybe that's the best way to say it. That's my hope.
I would agree with that. I would agree with that. He does seem very well thought through, and he does seem principled to the point you made, and he does seem to make his decisions based off of the information that he has available. And he's fought the establishment his whole career. So I feel pretty good from that. Going back to Rebel Capitalist, I'm super excited to come. Thanks for inviting me back.
Mike Green's going to be there. I don't know if I told you that. And I think Kiyosaki's going to go too. You can say hi to our good buddy.
I was just on his show. I just recorded with him right before I came on with you. And I was at his birthday. I didn't get to see you out there, unfortunately. Got to hang out with your buddy Ty. But what I was going to say is, last time I spoke at Rebel Capitalist, Bitcoin was at 20,000 after its high from 69,000. And I made the case. I said, I used your line. I said, is it cheap or expensive? And I kind of broke that down. And that was an amazing buying opportunity. If you're at Rebel Capitalist, you got some alpha. I set the price levels. I showed you where the targets were. You had a chance to get in at 20,000. And I'm going to bring something even bigger at this event. So I got some forecasts that I'm going to break down with math, that we're going to basically break these down with math, like from a venture capital lens. And I think it's going to blow most people's minds.
Awesome. 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 Got to get your tickets ASAP at rebelcapitalistlive.com. Mark, thanks a lot, buddy. And we'll see you here in maybe a month or so.
Yeah. Thanks, George.